Gopi jana valabha giri varadhari Yashoda nandana raja jana ranjana Yashoda nandana raja jana ranjana Yamuna tira vanachari Yamuna tira vanachari Jayam Vishnupad Brahmahamsa Parivada Vicharya Stotara Satoshi Srimad Divine Grace Sisi Bhakti Vedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Gita Srimad Bhagavatam Gita Samaveda Bhakta Vrinda Gita All glories to the Assembled Devotees All glories to Sri Sri Guru and Gauranga. Om Agyana Timirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Svayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Svapadantikam Vachakalpaturubhyasta Kripa Sindhubhya Ivacha Patitanam Bhavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Okay, we're starting a new chapter today, chapter 20, titled Studying the Structure of the Universe. I'm sure we're all very excited about this chapter. And there's a little summary of the chapter before the first text. I read it. It's probably, for conditioned souls like me, it's probably one of the most boring summaries in the Bhagavatam. Maybe I'll just give a summary of that. So the universe, are you going to show the video tomorrow? Or? Okay. Soon we're going to watch a video about the structure of the universe done by Dhanavir Maharaj. Earlier we had watched a video by Sadaputta about the structure of the universe. Now we'll see one by Dhanavir Maharaj. So the universe is like a giant sphere. Half of it's filled with ocean water. And then in the middle of the sphere there's this plane, a circular plane. That extends out almost to the limits of the universe. And that circular plane is called Bhumandala. In the center of that circular plane, there's an island called Jambudvip, which is, I think it's 800,000 miles. Yeah, 800,000 miles in diameter. And then there are concentric rings going out from the center of Jambudvip all the way out to near the edges of the universe. And that whole plane is called... And they're concentric rings of Land and oceans. So there's an island and there's an ocean and a land, ocean, like that, going all the way out. So previous chapters we were reading about the prayers by the denizens of Jambudvip, which is in the center island. And now we're going to be hearing about the prayers of the residents of each of the islands going out to the edge of the universe. So, and it's also described that each of the leaders of each of these regions or islands of the universe, they're all sons of Maharaj Priyavrata. So earlier we had read how Priyavrata, he was kind of like the ruler of the universe at one time, and he wasn't so happy with the way the sun was rotating around the universe, because when the sun was on one part of the universe, the other part was dark. So he wanted there to be light always, so he decided that he would, by his own mystic power, he would follow the sun. And then he would, by his own effulgence, he would light up the part of the universe that was dark. And then when he went or followed the sun, he created all these oceans and islands like that. And then when he wanted to move on, he passed along the rulership of these different islands to his sons. Okay, so we'll read text one. It's all in prose, so we'll just go ahead and read the translation and the purports. Text one, translation. The great sage Shukadeva Goswami said, "Hereafter, I shall describe the dimensions, characteristics, and forms of the six islands, beginning with the island of Plaksha." Two, as Sumeru Mountain is surrounded by Jambudvip, Jambudvip is also surrounded by an ocean of salt water. The breadth of Jambudvip is 800,000 miles, and the breadth of the saltwater ocean is the same. As a moat around a fort is sometimes surrounded by garden-like forest, the saltwater ocean surrounding Jambudvip is itself surrounded by Plakshadvip. The breadth of Plakshadvip is twice that of the saltwater ocean. In other words, 1,600,000 miles. On Plakshadvip, there is a tree shining like gold and as tall as the Jambu tree on Jambudvip. At its roots is a fire with seven flames. It is because this tree is a Plaksha tree that the island is called Plakshadvip. Plakshadvip was governed by Idmajiva, one of the sons of Maharaj Priyavrata. He endowed the seven islands with the names of his seven sons, divided the island among the sons, and then retired from active life to engage in devotional service of the Lord. And next verse. Translation. The seven islands, or Varshas, are named according to the names of those seven sons: Shiva, Yavasa, Subhadra, Shanta, Kshema, Amrita, and Abhaya. In those seven tracts of land, there are seven mountains and seven rivers. The mountains are named Manikuta, Vajrakuta, Indrasena, Jyotishman, Suparna, Hiranyastiva, and Meghamala. And the rivers are named Karuna, Rimna, Angirasi, Savitri, Suptbhata, Ritambhara, and Satyambhara. One can immediately be free from material contamination by touching or bathing in those rivers. And the four castes of people who live in Plakshadvip, the Hunksas, Patungas, Urdhvayanas, and Satyangas, purify themselves in that way. The inhabitants of Plakshadvip live for 1,000 years. They are beautiful like the demigods, and they also beget children like the demigods. By completely performing the ritualistic ceremonies mentioned in the Vedas, and by worshipping the Supreme Personality of Godhead as represented by the sun god, they attain the sun, which is a heavenly planet. Imagine the memory that Shukadeva Goswami must have had to remember all these names of some rivers and oceans. Just, without looking, does anybody remember a single name? Plakshadvip, does anyone remember any of the rivers? What's that? Arunam, is that one of them? Okay. Anyway, just glorifying trying to glorify Shukadeva Goswami's memory. And we're, highlighting where our memory's at. Okay, the purport. It's a pretty long purport. According to general understanding, there are originally three deities: Lord Brahma, Lord Vishnu, and Lord Shiva. And people with a poor fund of knowledge consider Lord Vishnu no better than Lord Brahma or Lord Shiva. This conclusion, however, is invalid. As stated in the Vedas, bunch of Sanskrit, I'll skip. This means that the Supreme Lord, who accepts and enjoys the results of Vedic ritualistic ceremonies, technically called Ishtapurta, who maintains the entire creation, who supplies the necessities of all living entities, and who is also the central point of all creation, is Lord Vishnu. Lord Vishnu expands as the demigods known as Agni, Vayu, Surya, and Chandra, who are simply parts and parcels of his body. Lord Krishna says in Srimad Bhagavatam 9:23, Ye pranya devata bhakta yajante shradhayan vitaha te pi mam eva kaunteya yajanta vidhi purvakam. Quote, devotees who worship the demigods with firm faith worship me also, but not according to regulative principles. End quote. In other words, if one worships the demigods but does not understand the relationship between the demigods and the Supreme Personality of Godhead, his worship is irregular. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita 9:24, Aham hi sarva yajnanam bhukta cha prabhur eva cha. Quote, I am the enjoyer of ritualistic ceremonies. It may be argued that the demigods are as important as Lord Vishnu because the names of the demigods are different names of Vishnu. This, however, is not a sound conclusion, for it is a contradict for it is contradicted in the Vedic literatures. The Vedas declare, quote, the demigod of the moon, Chandra, came from the mind of Narayana, and the sun god came from his eyes. The controlling deities of hearing and the life air came from Narayana, and the controlling deity of fire was generated from his mouth. Prajapati, Lord Brahma, came from Narayana. Indra came from Narayana. And the eight Vasus, the 11 expansions of Lord Shiva, and the 12 Adityas also came from Narayana. End quote. In the Smriti Vedic literature, it is also said, quote, Brahma, Shambhu, Surya, and Indra are all merely products of the power of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This is also true of the many other demigods whose names are not mentioned here. When the cosmic manifestation is annihilated, these different expansions of Narayana's potencies will merge into Narayana. In other words, all these demigods will die. Their living force will be withdrawn, and they will merge into Narayana. End quote. Therefore, it should be concluded that Lord Vishnu, not Lord Brahma or Lord Shiva, is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. As a government officer is sometimes accepted as the entire government, although he is actually but a departmental manager, so the demigods, having achieved power of attorney from Vishnu, act on his behalf, although they are not as powerful as he. All the demigods must work under the orders of Vishnu. Therefore, it is said, Ekaleshvara Krishna Ara Sabha Britya. The only master is Lord Krishna, or Lord Vishnu, and all others are his obedient servants, who act exactly according to his orders. The distinction between Lord Vishnu and the demigods is also expressed in Bhagavad Gita, 9:25, Yanti Deva Vrata Devan, Yanti Madhyagyo Pimam. Those who worship the demigods go to the planets of the demigods, whereas the worshippers of Lord Krishna and Lord Vishnu go to the planets in Vaikuntha. These are the statements of the Smriti. Therefore, the idea that Lord Vishnu is on the same level as the demigods is in contradiction to the Shastras. The demigods are not supreme. The supremacy of the demigods is dependent on the mercy of Lord Narayana, Vishnu, or Krishna. Okay, so this verse is about how the residents of Plakshadweep, they engage in performing ritualistic ceremonies, and they worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead as represented by the sun god. So they're doing all these activities so that they can one day get the benefit of eventually going to the sun planet, which is a heavenly planet. So Prabhupada in the purport takes the opportunity to say, well, actually, the only person who's the enjoyer of the results of your ritualistic ceremonies is Vishnu. That's the only enjoyer, not other demigods. So Prabhupada explains, what is the position of the demigods? What is the position of Vishnu? What is the relationship between the demigods and Vishnu? And what is proper worship of the demigods? And what is improper worship of the demigods? So generally when we think of, when we hear about worshiping, we were discussing the other day in Bhagavad Gita class that there are levels, there's a hierarchy of worship. The lowest level of worship is where one worships oneself. And then a little higher than worshiping oneself is worshiping the demigods. Higher than worshiping the demigods is worshiping the Virat Rupa, or the universal form of the Supreme Lord, and you know, it's like found in nature and things. Then higher than worshiping the Virat Rupa is worshiping the Brahman feature of the Supreme Lord. And then higher than worshiping the Brahman feature is worshiping the Paramatma feature. And then higher than worshiping the Paramatma feature is worshiping Vishnu, but for some material gains. And then higher than worshiping Vishnu for material gains is worshiping Krishna. So there's quite a span of ways that we can worship. And demigod worship is kind of on the lower rung of the kind of worship that one can do. And even within demigod worship, well, we can think of demigod worship as having its own hierarchies also. So if we just focus in on demigod worship, there's lower forms of demigod worship, middle levels of demigod worship, and like the higher levels of demigod worship. So the lowest level of, or the lower levels of demigod worship include worshiping demigods, but without a clear conception of who is Vishnu, a clear conception that Vishnu is the supreme, and then that the demigods are dependent on Vishnu. So it's worshiping with misconceptions. So many people might worship demigods for different reasons. Some might just do it whimsically. They think, oh, you know, this demigod's really cool or something. You know, Shiva, he smokes ganja, so therefore I like him, I'll worship him. Or, you know, someone might hear about how if you worship demigods, you can get certain material benefits. So they think, oh, great, so I'll worship the demigods, but they really have no idea who's supreme, they're just worshiping. Or someone might be indebted to some demigod because they might have, they believe that they helped them through some difficulty in their life. So then they'll or some obstacle. So they'll feel obliged to worship different demigods. Or maybe they were just born into a family that worshiped demigods. So they don't understand how, you know, Vishnu fits in with the demigods. They just are following mechanically because that's how they were brought up. So these are different ways in which one worships demigods on the lower level of worship. But even that worship is better than doing nothing at all. So it's still somewhat progressive in the sense that if we worship demigods, one is that we can't see the demigods, so we have to have faith in some higher authority. So that's already a pretty good step if we have faith in some higher authority. So therefore, it's beneficial. Another reason why it's okay is that it requires one to go to somebody to learn how to worship the different demigods. So it requires you to go to somebody and seek guidance. Otherwise, you wouldn't know what to do. So that's another fundamental principle in spiritual life, which makes demigod worship, this kind of demigod worship, okay? And then another is that it prevents us from neglecting the demigods. Because the demigods, they're representatives of Vishnu, and it's described here that the Vishnu expands as the demigods, and that they also act as witnesses. So that they have a position, and we should respect them. And we might even worship them. But never bud. We should never, like, you know, like, it's never like we offer our whole heart to the demigods or anything. Bhaj is reserved for Krishna, you know, Bhaj Govinda. But we can certainly offer respect to the demigods. We should offer respect to all living entities, including the ants, what to speak of the demigods. So at least if there worshiping demigods like this, there's some they're respecting, and that's pretty good. Of course, we're, you know, we practice Krishna bhakti, so we don't really have to do so many of these things because we're watering the root of the tree. So by worshiping Krishna, we're automatically satisfying all the demigods. So we don't have to do individual programs for worshiping the demigods. So this is kind of like the lower level of demigod worship. Then one, like a higher level of demigod worship is the kind of worship that we're reading here in this verse, where persons, they worship demigods, but they have a very clear idea that Vishnu is supreme. But they're still worshiping demigods so that they can get some kind of material benefit. So now they have a proper conception, but they're still worshiping demigods for some material gain. So it's a little higher than the first one, but it's not the highest. So here the example is that they're worshiping the sun god so that they can go to the sun planet and probably enjoy there. So that's the next level. And then even higher than that, there's a perhaps the highest level of demigod worship is where you do demigod worship, but you're not really into it. You just kind of do it because of social pressures or something. But internally, you're praying to the demigods for some benediction in relation to Krishna. So you're doing demigod worship, but ultimately you're thinking, I want to be with Krishna. So there's examples given in the shastras about this kind of demigod worship. One is Rukmini. So Rukmini is the principal queen of Dwarka, or principal wife of Krishna. And before she got married to Krishna, she used to worship the demigods, as did most women when they were young in the Vedic times. So Rukmini really, she heard about Krishna and she really, really wanted to marry Krishna. But her older brother, Rukmi, was kind of envious of Krishna, and he didn't want Rukmini to marry Krishna. So Rukmi arranged for Rukmini to marry Shishupal. And Rukmini wasn't so happy about that. So she decided that she would write a letter to Krishna. And, you know, Krishna, please come. I'm arranged to be married to the Shishupal, but I don't want to be touched by him or any of his family. I don't want to have anything to do with him. I want to marry you. Can you please come and save me from this situation and take me away? And I want to marry you. So when Krishna got this letter from Rukmini, you know, he was also really wanting to marry Rukmini. You know, they were meant to be together. And this was like an open secret too. Everybody knew that Krishna, Rukmini was supposed to be married to Krishna. So when people found out that, well, Rukmini was going to be married to Shishupal, everyone was suspecting that Krishna was going to do something. He wasn't going to let this happen. So while they were making arrangements, they were cleaning the city, making decorations, doing all the preparation for the marriage ceremony, Shishupal's family was worried that Krishna is going to come and disrupt things. So they came prepared. They came with soldiers and fighting gear, and they came ready to fight if Krishna were to come and cause some disturbance. So, they kind of had an idea that Rukmini sent a letter to Krishna asking him to come. It was kind of a rumor, but they also kind of knew about that. So when Krishna got the letter, the time was running out because basically the letter said, I'm getting married tomorrow. You need to come right now. Otherwise, I'm going to get married to the Shishupal. So then Krishna, all right, I'm going to go right now. So he got his driver, Daruka, and went right to Kundin, which is the place where this marriage is going to take place. And he came all the way from Dwarka. Dwarka is on the western side of India. And Kundin's like 1,000 miles away on the northern side of India. So he had to go 1,000 miles in just one night, which not more than 12 hours. So if you do the math, Krishna would have had to have been traveling at an average speed of 83 miles per hour to get there on time, which is breaking the speed limit here in America. And of course, Krishna can do anything. But what something that I don't really understand was that Balaram, when he found out that Krishna was going to Kundan to try to save Rukmini from this marriage, and he also found out that in Kundan there was all these military soldiers ready to fight with Krishna if he were to do something. So Balaram, seeing an opportunity for service, he thought, okay, well, I should also come and help out and bring the Yadu army just in case there's a fight, we can help Krishna. So he also came with, cavalry and infantry and elephants and a lot of soldiers. Now, I don't know how he was able to get from Dwarka to Kundin in one night also, because, I don't know, elephants are kind of slow and infantry, they're walking. So I can understand, okay, maybe Krishna can do it, but the Yadu army... So, anyway. Anyway, nevertheless, Rukmini, they got there in time. Although, they got there just in time. So, Rukmini, the whole night before marriage, she was in great anxiety about, whether Krishna would come or not. She was, because she kept thinking of, she was absorbed in Krishna, is Krishna coming? And, she had different ideas why Krishna didn't come yet. First, she thought that, well, maybe Krishna just rejected my proposal. He read my letter and he wasn't pleased or something, so he just rejected it and he's not coming. And that made her kind of sad. And she was also thinking that, well, maybe the demigods are not happy with my worship of them, because I hear that demigods get angry sometimes if we don't worship them properly. So maybe, because my family has a tradition of worshiping Durga, so I've done worship of Durga, but I kind of didn't really worship Lord Brahma or Lord Shiva. So maybe because they felt neglected, they decided to create some obstacle for, they didn't make arrangements for Krishna and I to marry. So she started kind of getting ups, she started thinking ill towards the demigods. She thought the demigods were kind of like the Himalayan mountains. They're very cold and hard-hearted because they were blocking, Krishna and Rukmini from marrying each other. So anyway, she had these ideas the night before her marriage. So then the following day, it's her family tradition that before getting married, that the bride, she goes to the temple of goddess Durga and they worship goddess Durga. And then after that, there was a whole marriage ceremony. So, as Rukmini was going to the temple, she worshipped. She actually engaged in demigod worship. She did the whole thing. She offered incense and flowers and fruits and everything. She worshipped a demigod, a Durga, and she also accepted her prasadam. And then she offered prayers. My dear goddess, please accept my obeisances, and please accept and my obeisances to you and to your children. So Durga has four children. There's Lakshmi, Saraswati's daughters, and then there's Ganesh and Kartikeya as sons. So she showed how to offer respect to the demigods. So she went there and she offered her obeisances, and she showed her respect. She wasn't internally, she wasn't so into the whole ceremony. She didn't really in, not into the whole demigod worship, but internally she was praying, please, please arrange for Krishna to become my husband. She was praying with great devotion to the demigod, to give demigoddess Durga for this benediction. Most people, when they pray to Durga, it's like they pray for something material. But Rukmini's consciousness was very different. Then after she got done worshiping, she walked out of the temple. She was holding the hands of her girlfriend, and she started walking very slowly. And then it's this part of the ceremony, all of the princes and kshatriyas and everybody, they're outside the temple waiting for Rukmini to come out because they were all eager to see her. In fact, everybody wanted to marry her because she was so beautiful. was described that the Kshatriyas, they all thought that Rukmini was specially created, manufactured by the creator in order to bewilder the minds of the chivalrous Kshatriyas there. So they all wanted to marry Rukmini, so they were thinking, oh, there's still a chance. She's not married yet, so maybe we can still marry her. So all the Kshatriya kings were lined up, but she wasn't interested in any of them, and she wasn't even proud of the fact that everybody was wanting to marry her. She was just constantly absorbed in Krishna, always thinking at any step, Krishna can come and take me away and get me out of this situation. So she walked very slowly out of the temple toward her home, and she noticed among the princes and the Kshatriyas that were there that Krishna was one of them. So she became very happy. She had never seen Krishna before, but she knew immediately that, oh, Krishna is here, and because she heard about Krishna, and she knew that Krishna was there. So then it was described that Krishna took Rukmini on his chariot and drove off. And it was described that kind of like a lion comes in and takes the deer carcass of a bunch of jackals. You know, so similarly, Krishna came in and took Rukmini and just left. And of course, that didn't go over so well with the other princes that were there. And anyway, a whole war ensued. And, you know, so anyway, so then Balaram was there ready to fight, and there's a big war and all kinds of stuff. But nevertheless, because Rukmini was praying to Goddess Durga that Krishna can be her husband, that he would come and take her away from the situation, and Krishna came and he fulfilled that. So that was one example of a kind of demigod worship, which is very, very high, the most exalted kind of demigod worship. And then there's also another famous story of, you know, the gopis. According to Vedic tradition, women, girls who are between the ages of 10 and 14, they're supposed to worship Lord Shiva or Goddess Durga in order to get a good husband. So the gopis, they were worshiping Durga every day. So they woke up in the morning, they took bath, and then they made a little, I don't know, some kind of deity of Durga made out of sand and earth. And then they worshipped Durga, you know, similar to the way that Rukmini did with incense and garlands and did the whole thing. Praying, you know, praying, oh, supreme energy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, oh goddess, please be kind upon us and arrange for our marriage with Krishna. So, they were praying like that. They also were doing a vow. For 1 month, they did this Katyayani Vrata, where they only ate unspiced khichdi. Khichdi with no spices in it. That's all they ate for an entire month. Could you imagine doing such a vow? Pretty tough. So they did this, and at the end of their 1 month Vrata, they were kind of, you know, okay, happy it was over, and they were kind of in a festive mood, and they decided that, okay, we're going to go celebrate. We're going to go play in the Yamuna. So they got Radharani and other important gopis, and they went and they took off their clothes and went and, you know, played in the Yamuna. And then Krishna very well knew the desires of the gopis, and he knew that their vrata was over. So normally when women are bathing in a certain portion of the Yamuna, men are not allowed entrance. It's like strictly forbidden from entering that portion. But Krishna entered anyway, because he knew the desires of the gopis. And he also brought with him some of his young friends, some toddlers, or the ages between 2 and 3. And the cows also came, because the cows didn't want to go without Krishna. So Krishna and the cows and the toddlers, they all went to this portion of the Yamuna. So then Krishna stole the clothes, you know, because he was putting, you know, joking with the gopis, I guess. He stole the clothes and then ran up in a kadamba tree, and then he started laughing. So, and then when he started laughing, the toddlers started laughing also. Then there was like this really, you know, funny exchanges between Krishna and the gopis. They were both joking with each other. Krishna was trying to convince the gopis to come out of the water to pick up their clothes. You know, come out and get your clothes, I have them. But the gopis, they obviously didn't want to come out because they didn't want to expose themselves. So they were trying to get Krishna to go away. so that they can, bathe peacefully. So, Krishna said, please come out and get your clothes. And, the gopis came from aristocratic, respectable families, so this was not something that they were go that it was really proper for them to do. So they could have just said, just leave the clothes by the side of the bank and go away. What are you doing here? And then Krishna would have responded, well, but there's so many of you. If I just leave the clothes here, what if one of you takes the clothes of another gopi? Then, that might happen. And the gopis were like, no, we're honest. We don't steal anything. That's ridiculous. We don't touch the properties of another. And then Krishna would say, but okay, well, if that's the case, then why don't you come out and get your clothes? What's the difficulty? So anyway, they were joking with each other like that. And the gopis, they were not exactly sure. They didn't really want to come out. So, but they kind of liked this joking that Krishna was doing with them. So they decided that they were kind of trying to urge other gopis to go first. Okay, you go first, and then we'll see if Krishna plays any tricks on you, and then we'll go. So, but none of them went. They didn't want to go right away. So then Krishna decided, all right, I'm getting kind of tired. If none of you come, I'm gonna make a hammock out of your clothes. I'm gonna tie it to this tree, and I'm gonna take a nap. I'm gonna stay here, and I'm gonna sleep here, waiting for you girls to come out. And then the gopis are like, they're just trying to think of ways to get Krishna to leave, and so that they can come out. So they said, well, your cows, they're over there. They're going to graze in the caves. You should go get them quickly, but put them on the right path. Krishna wasn't fooled by that. So he said, don't you girls have some like household responsibilities to do or something? Aren't your parents going to be worried about you, where you are? And don't, what about the elders in your community? You should come out and so that you can go home. And the gopi said, well, we're actually doing a vrata, Katyayani vrata. We're fasting from eating. We're doing this vow of fasting, so we're not going to go home for another month. This is what they told him. And then Krishna said, oh, really? I also now just developed this spirit of detachment, and I also want to take a vow. And my vow is that I want to be like a cloud for 1 month. So I want to stay up here in this tree like a cloud for 1 month. He said, unless you gopis show your mercy, then I would be happy to come down there and join you in your vow of fasting for 1 month in your company. I would be happy to do that too. So anyway, this joking was going on back and forth between Krishna and the gopis finally at one point just said, okay, Krishna, we're your maidservants, so we must do whatever you say. But please just give us back our clothes. And otherwise, if you don't give us back our clothes, we're going to tell the king. And Krishna said, well, what can the king do? if you really are my maidservants, then you would do as I say. You would come out and you would get your clothes. So then the gopis were defeated by their own words. At this point, they couldn't do anything. So, the gopis thought among themselves that, okay, well, there's really no other alternatives. And if we have to do it, might as well do it now so we can get it out of the way, just in case any other man decides to come, which would be really a disaster. At least let's just do it now and get it over with. So then they came out of the water to get their clothes, and they were covering themselves with their hands. And then Krishna said, you girls, you committed a big offense because you were bathing naked in the Yamuna, in the river, so you created an offense to Varunadeva, the god of water, the demigod of water. So in order to counteract that offense, you should raise your palms above your head and you should offer your obeisances. So this really, Krishna wanted to see full surrender. So now they weren't able to cover themselves, they were completely just surrendered to what Krishna was wanting them to do. Now, the gopis, they didn't really care so much about offending Varuna or anything, but they wanted to please Krishna, and they'll be willing to do whatever it takes to please Krishna. So they complied. Now, if any of us were in a situation like that, we'd immediately become lusty or something, but Krishna is completely transcendental. He didn't have any attraction to the gopis. He was only attracted to their love. You know, they gave everything, they surrendered everything to Krishna, and that is what attracted Krishna, not some, you know, sexual affairs with young ladies or anything. He was not at all interested in that. So then they came out and they got dressed, and then Krishna said, okay, now go back to Vraja, and then in the coming nights we'll enjoy each other's company. So it says in the Vedic culture that a woman is not supposed to spend the night with any man other than her husband. So that, because Krishna said that I will enjoy with you in the coming nights, means that he agreed to their proposal that he would become their husband. And thus the gopis got their desire fulfilled for having Krishna as their husband by worshipping Katyayani. So it's not that because the gopis worshipped Katyayani that Katyayani was pleased, and therefore Katyayani bestowed upon the gopis the benediction of having Krishna as their husband. But rather, it was the gopis' bhava that, you know, that they don't go directly to Krishna, but rather they go through the devotees. You know, that bhava attracts Krishna. You know, the gopis are very, very, very humble. They don't go directly to Krishna. And this humility attracts Krishna. And then because Krishna is attracted by that humility, then he bestows his mercy. So that's one way of understanding. So this is like the highest level of demigod worship. So I was thinking how demigod worship applies to me, because I was born in here in Illinois, and so I had no exposure to demigod worship growing up, and I joined the Hare Krishna movement where we weren't really encouraged to worship demigods. We were encouraged, well, just worship Krishna. There's no need to worship demigods because we're worshiping Krishna. So I was wondering, okay, how does demigod worship apply to me? Or does it apply? And the answer is yes, it applies. Because one day, we might be in this situation. you know, Krishna's doing his traveling roadshow all over the universe, and he's performing very many beautiful pastimes to attract us to go to the spiritual world. Come join our roadshow and go back to the spiritual world. So, by practicing, you know, sadhana bhakti and developing more and more in Krishna consciousness, and if we come to the perfectional stages, it's described that even if we perfect our life in this body, we don't go back to the spiritual world right away. We actually have to take at least one more birth, and that we have to take one more birth in one of the universes where Krishna is having his pastimes. So we take birth at the place where Krishna is having his pastimes so that we can get our final training for, you know, how to serve Krishna. We already have total love for God. We're already pure devotees at this point. But we have to go take birth in Gokul or something and get the final training, the particular aspects of how we should serve Krishna. So when we take birth there, we can actually see Krishna and relate with Krishna and serve Krishna here in the material world, in one sense. And then after that birth, then we can go to the spiritual world, Goloka Vrindavan. So if we ever come to the point of taking birth in Gokul, we might be in the situation where we're going to take birth in the womb of a gopi, and we're going to turn 10 or 10 to 14 at some point in our life. You know, as we grow older, the society is going to be such that we're going to be expected to worship demigods, namely, you know, Shiva or Durga, and we're going to be trained up on how to worship demigods so that we can so that we can get Krishna as our husband or something. So it still applies. I was thinking this could be one way how it applies. So anyway, I didn't really know so much about what to say on this verse, so this is the thoughts that I had. Is there anything that anyone would like to add to this discussion? Yes, Raktak Prabhu?
Thank you for the class. On the Lord's traveling roadshow throughout the universe, is it like just one traveling roadshow, or are there many expansions?
I'm not sure. I mean, it wouldn't be inconceivable for Krishna to be in multiple universes at the same time doing pastimes in multiple universes. But Prabhupada did describe it as a traveling roadshow, that he goes from universe to universe doing his pastimes to attract the living entities back to him. So I'm not sure exactly if it's happening simultaneously or if it's one after another. But nevertheless, it's always happening. There's always somewhere where it's going on, in some universe in the material world, somewhere it's going on. So there's always a chance for you to take birth in that place where it's going on. Okay, yes, Tasha Krishna.
Thanks for the class, bro. I was thinking, when we read this type of purports about worship demigods, it seems like the demigods are like evil characters or something like that. But finally, they are servants of the Lord, of Lord Krishna. And the problem are not the demigods. The problem is the consciousness of the worshipper. What do you think about that aspect? How do you understand?
Well, I mean, even in the purport, it says that Vishnu expands as the demigods. So they're obviously very important. And if we actually understand the position of the demigods properly, then we'll respect them accordingly as being representatives of God, you know, empowered by Krishna to perform very important functions in the material universe. Yeah, I was also curious, I don't know this for sure, but I was also curious to know if there's demigods in the spiritual world. So I found there's this verse in the second canto where it says that both the demons and the demigods, they're pure devotees in the spiritual world, in the Lord's abode. Both the demigods and the demons, they're both pure devotees of Krishna. And now, they didn't describe that. Prabhupada, there's no explanation about what that means, that there's demigods and demons in the Lord's abode, and that they're both pure devotees. So I don't know so much about it, but it seems like demigods are there also in the spiritual world. So obviously they're very exalted. So we can think like that. Of course, Prabhupada warns us in the purport that we shouldn't think of them as equal to Vishnu. There's definitely a distinction there. Therefore, the idea that Lord Vishnu is on the same level as the demigods is in contradiction to the Shastras. The demigods are not supreme. So that's just the way it is. Okay. Yeah, Luke.
Very good. Thank you, bro, very much. So I was thinking, it's interesting because even one might worship a demigod, but the position of the devotee is so exalted. For example, Krishna himself descends as Lord Chaitanya just to experience the bliss of being a pure devotee. Other Vishnu expansions, like Vishnu Tattva personalities on the level of Vishnu Tattva, also descend, namely Advaita Acharya, you know, just to experience the bliss of becoming in the position of a devotee. And sorry, there was one other point. Krishna says, my pure devotees are more dear to me than Balaram and Lakshmi. That my pure bhakta means like those who are servants and associates of Radharani and you know, also Balaram. Have you heard this shloka? You're familiar with that one?
I haven't heard the one that they're more dear than Balaram, but I've heard about Lakshmi.
Okay.
How Krishna's real devotees, namely the gopis, are more dear to him than Lakshmi. There's a verse like that that I remember, but I don't remember hearing one about Balaram.
I'll
I don't know. Maybe
I'll look it up and confirm. So anyway, I was just thinking in this regard, like we may have affection and appreciation and of course respect for all living entities, but in our heart we also will appreciate, like Prabhupada is saying, the super excellent position of Krishna. The more we hear about him and become attracted to his qualities and pastimes. And then additionally, the supreme, super excellent position of his pure devotees. And we hear about their qualities and their pastimes and become attracted to rendering service to them. It's an interesting topic that demigod worship goes on in the spiritual world. It's kind of far out, like Radharani will go to worship Suryadev.
Yeah.
You know, but it's just like Leela. It facilitates the loving exchange with Krishna.
So it takes Madhavendra Puri describes it as being a joke.
Yeah, it's
you know, Varnashram is like a joke in the spiritual world.
Yeah.
Demigod worship is just a big joke. Meant to enhance the Leela, right?
Yeah. So that's very attractive, I guess.
Yeah.
Hare Krishna.
Thanks. Yeah, Glenn?
I'm not at all averse in this issue. It's just that I feel like the messages I'm hearing are really confusing to me. They're mixed messages. And Prabhupada doesn't seem to at all be encouraging us. In fact, discouraging us, advising us not to be involved in deity worship, and yet the scriptures are saying...
Demigod worship.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't.
Well, in the Bhagavad Gita, it says that generally those who have material desires, well, a lot of material desires, they'll worship demigods, and they're considered to be less intelligent. That's a verse in the Bhagavad Gita. So Krishna himself doesn't necessarily recommend demigod worship. You know, he says worship me. You know, and don't worship. So in Bhagavad Gita, that's true. That it's better just to worship Krishna. I was talking about a you know, for example, even though like Lord Chaitanya, he used to go visit temples of Lord Shiva, who's considered to be a demigod. So the Lord himself, he went and go and paid respects, you know, to demigod Lord Shiva. So it's not that you should, the idea is that you shouldn't like worship the demigods with all of your heart, like there's this word budge. You shouldn't give your heart to the demigods as being the supreme or anything. But you can respect them and even worship them, but you should always understand that Krishna is the supreme. So like Lord Chaitanya, he went to go offer respects to Shiva when he was doing his tour of South India. And he showed by his example that there's ways to do it properly and there's ways to do it improperly. So we got to know the difference.
Yeah, thank you. I was thinking also another way you're indicating these different levels of demigod worship. Another, perhaps the highest form would be worshiping demigods as devotees, like Lord Shiva, for example. Understanding his position, he's actually considered
right,
the greatest Vaishnava. So he maybe he's kind of like considered a demigod.
Right.
But if one worships him, one can worship the Vaishnavas wholeheartedly. Of course, there's different degrees of demigods also. But so if one worships Lord Shiva as a devotee,
right,
that can be a very
That's a good point
advantageous
too.
Type of worship.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, it's selfless. It's not that I want anything. And it's to facilitate one's devotion to Krishna, as you were saying. And if I was going to just share one thing from the Bhagavatam. It's a little bit long, but maybe if anyone has another question, we could take that. This was just in context of, I remember hearing this about the particular form that the gopis were worshipping. So just because you were mentioning the past, I might just read it. It's from a purport in the Bhagavatam. According to various acharyas, the goddess Durga mentioned in this verse is not the illusory energy of Krishna called Maya, but rather the internal potency of the Lord known as Yoga Maya. The distinction between the internal and external, or illusory potency of the Lord, is described in the Narada Pancharatra. The Lord's inferior potency, known as Durga, is dedicated to his loving service. Being the Lord's potency, this inferior energy is non-different from him. There is another superior potency whose form is on the same spiritual level as that of God himself. Simply by scientifically understanding this supreme potency, one can immediately achieve the supreme soul of all souls, who is the Lord of all lords. There is no other process to achieve him. So one must understand the internal potency. That supreme potency of the Lord is known as Gokuleshwari, the goddess of Gokul. Her nature is to be completely absorbed in love of God, and through her one can easily obtain the primeval God, the Lord of all that be. This internal potency of the Lord has a covering potency known as Mahamaya, who rules the material world. In fact, she bewilders the entire universe, and thus everyone within the universe falsely identifies himself with the material body. From the above, we can understand, and then end quote, from the above, we can understand that the internal and external, or superior and inferior potencies of the Supreme Lord are personified as Yogamaya and Mahamaya, respectively. The name Durga is sometimes used to refer to the internal, superior potency, as stated in the Pancharatra. Quote, in all mantras used to worship Krishna, the presiding deity is known as Durga, end quote. Thus, in the transcendental sound vibrations glorifying and worshiping the absolute truth Krishna, the presiding deity of the particular mantra or hymn is called Durga. The name Durga therefore refers also to that personality who functions as the internal potency of the Lord, and who is thus on the platform of Shuddhasattva, pure transcendental existence. This internal potency is understood to be Krishna's sister, known as Ekanamsha or Subhadra. This is the Durga who was worshipped by the gopis in Vrindavan. Several acharyas have pointed out that ordinary people are sometimes bewildered and think that the names of Mahamaya and Durga refer exclusively to the external potency of the Lord. So quite interesting, just for our all benefit. And then there was one other sentence I wanted to share. Srila Narottam Das Thakur has strictly forbidden all worship of the demigods for anyone who wants to advance in pure devotional service.
Yeah, if you continue reading that purport, it says that even if you argue that the gopis are worshiping the external energy of the Supreme Lord Durga as, you know, not the internal potency but the external potency, it would still be okay. There would still be no fault with the gopis. So, they are, according to the purport, they are worshiping the internal potency when they worship Durga, but even if they are doing the external, it's still okay. For us, we're not going to start engaging in deity worship, or demigod worship. That won't really help us so much, because we're already engaged in Krishna bhakti, so for us, that Srila Narottam Das Thakur's instruction is more applicable in our situation now. Okay. Any last quick comments? Okay, we'll stop here. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.